good for everybody to introduce themselves. So I'm May Okihiro, and I'm the director of I-4.
And I'm Gina Warren, the child and adolescent psychiatry fellow.
Oh, good.
I'm Ron Budoy, I'm the pediatrician.
He's the chair of the department.
I'm Susie LaFontaine, director of rehab services.
Hi, I'm Rome Steinman with HECOR.
Rio Banner, I'm medical director of the Aloha Care.
And I'm Rachel Mabani. I'm with nutrition at
So I asked Rachel to come because we've been kind of working together. Rachel has been with the university for how many years now? Postdoc.
Three.
2021.
And she's doing lots of interesting work in Hawaii as well as across the Pacific through Macronesia and in Samoa too. On looking at nutrition, childhood nutrition, adult nutrition, a lot of studies in women, ethnic differences, and also body composition differences and how they affect our risk. And I've been interested in that, and I think it really impacts how pediatricians, what the risks are in chronic disease prevention. So I asked Rachel to come and talk about part of the work.
So, welcome. Is this, does this turn off, or shall I just use the computer? So I chose to talk today mostly about our female adolescent maturation study, but we've been chatting here, and I'm involved in a couple of other intervention studies that several of us have been talking about. I'd be happy to spend some time chatting about towards the end. I think my talk will be about a half an hour, so we may have some time we could talk about some other things, because we've got a couple of different intervention studies that are not yet finished, so I don't really have, I could talk about what we're doing, but I don't really have complete data to show you yet. That's why I chose not to focus on them. This study, the FAM study, has been going on for a while now in Hawaii, and we've got some results, and also the data are available. They're not, just loosely available, but I'd be happy to collaborate with you if you have some interest in some of the things we're doing, and we're still looking at other add-on studies as well. So I'm interested in letting people know what's there, because I think there is a lot more that could be done with what we have. Is this what I'm supposed to be using? I'll just use this. Just from my own perspective, I'm not going to go into this, but as you know, I'm interested in health broadly, not only obesity, but I have been focusing of late on obesity. I actually come from undernutrition. I worked overseas with malnutrition at the beginning of my career in several different countries, mostly in Latin America. And just as people started getting fatter, I started working towards that end of the spectrum. But I've always worked with growth periods as periods of vulnerability and opportunities in a public health arena to make changes and to have an impact. And while I've ended up, I actually came to nutrition as a basic need more than as, people sort of guess as a dietitian and so on, which I did after my PhD. I came from living in third world countries and saying, okay, let's start with food. But clearly food intake is related to obesity, as is energy expenditure. But when we come to talk about interventions, we need to think about that place in the pathway. But clearly many, many things influence the intake and the expenditure. And for each setting, it's a process of figuring out what would be the most effective way of targeting an activity, a setting, to influence this energy balance and obesity. And I'm very much interested in that broader context, both from a cultural perspective as well as an environmental perspective. Although I feel, I want, as a scientist, want to make sure that I can really make the linkages. So I just like to just acknowledge to you that I do see, although I'm a nutritionist, I'm not narrowly focused only on the dietary factors, although I will talk a bit about them today. Okay, so I guess I can just put it down. So because I'm, as I mentioned, I like to focus on the growth periods, I see that as, from an intervention perspective, and from a biologic perspective, as a key opportunity to change the trajectory. We know there's certain kinds of programming, we know there's habits, and of course just growth in and of itself, the tissues themselves, particularly say for cancer, may be going through some processes that we would want to intervene on. So this, many of you know Terry Huang, is a conceptual framework he's recently described as this is coming out in the NIH RFAs as multi-level examination of the influences of obesity or body weight change. And so it's some of the same things. Here's the energy intake and expenditure, and many of those risk factors are viewed as influencing that, as of course are metabolic factors and genetic factors. But also, and this is another area I find myself now moving back again, which I worked on earlier in my career, to the early life exposures, the fetal period and the opportunities there, still yet another growth period to, as a time to intervene, and also a time when the medical system is in contact with people often, and if nothing else can capture risk indicators for our risk models. And so I'm especially interested in sort of this early life part of the whole process. And then again, and then I'm going to go into our own study, but this highlighting the infancy, childhood, adolescence period, this is another recent discussion of factors influencing obesity and body weight, but I tend to look at body fat accumulation. Right now the study is in adolescence, but I'm more and more looking at factors that influence the fat cells, their breakdown and their creation, and how that programs for later tissue partitioning, as well as indicators of risk that might be noted and used in the medical system or in other systems. And just beginning to actually measure growth hormone, IGF, and some of the hormonal changes that are going on there, I'm not going to be able to present those data, although we have been collecting hormones now in the FAM study. So as some of the mechanism that's influencing this tissue partitioning and higher risk for some of the complications of obesity. So if you haven't seen this, this is a nice thing to put on your door. clearly, there are many medical complications of obesity. And this is just a nice way of depicting a number of them. Although many of these are not in the childhood stage, it's predisposing for many of these conditions. And so as we try to develop risk tools, and as we try to quantify economic costs and so on and justify our programs to work with obesity, these are some of the tools we can use to talk with people about all these various conditions that are part of the picture when we're dealing with obesity. Okay, so measures of obesity, as you well know, most often these days we use body mass index, weight over meters squared, to describe overweight and obesity, and that this is a measure of, as it says, mass. So it includes lean mass as well as fat mass and bone. And so we have learned that the body fat tissue is more predictive of many of the health and disease risks as compared to the overall BMI, and independently of BMI, so in addition to BMI. And especially central and upper body fat distribution. In several different studies, cardiovascular disease risk in particular has been studied, but it's more and more being shown that knowing the body fat is helpful. So the FAM studies that I'm going to talk about today began as an observational cohort to look at ethnic, genetic, dietary, physical activity, and hormonal factors influencing body composition, bone, and onset of puberty as risk factors for later chronic disease. It began, I was at the time studying bone and looking at risk factors for osteoporosis, and he kept coming to, well, really the best prevention of osteoporosis is build more bone when you're a child. But then when you really look at what helps children build bone, it is in direct opposition to almost everything else we wanted to promote. It was estrogen, weight, you know, all these things that were, you know, so I was saying, well, so what's the sweet spot there? And actually, some of the clinicians I was talking to said, well, just ask people whether they'd rather have osteoporosis or other chronic disease. This is not acceptable. So that helped me develop this interest in really looking at the gradations of different patterns of growth and development and what maximized bone mass while yet not being overweight and obese. So that's how I got into this. So at this point, it's now a series of three observational studies with a nested cohort. So baseline and two follow-ups are the FAM studies. And we recruited from the Kaiser Permanente membership. They had to be Oahu residents. And at the time, we were especially interested in Asians. So we had eligibility criteria of being at least 50% Asian or white ancestry. And because of our interest in bone, we didn't want medications that would influence bone. So basically, they were healthy children that we selected. And a lot of IRBs have been involved over the years, so keep us very busy. So at baseline, we recruited 349 girls into the FAM study that we were able to bring back a few years later, sort of able to save some money and bring them back. So there's a small cohort there. And then we got another grant together. I got it together with Loic Lumachan. And so he has brought the genetic and hormonal component to the studies. And we brought back some of the original girls and added some new girls. So there's now a total of about 529 girls altogether. With a nested cohort. So their ages are 9 to 14 at FAM 1, 11 to 16 at FAM 2, and 13 to 20 at FAM 3. And another thing that we did that has been part of our analytic work is we were interested in the mixed race ethnicity. As you know, it's very common in Hawaii, and I see that as a very special opportunity we have to really, rather than always be trying to, you know, just find the pure people and not, you know, not mess up our definitions, to study it. You know, we have an opportunity to really look at this mixing in a way that a lot of places don't. So we did this reporting of race and ethnic ancestry of each biologic parent that we now call the blend method. And it looks like this. So we ask, for each child, what is the ethnicity of each biologic parent? And we ask them to report in percent. So each parent has to add up to 100, mother and father. And we organized it so that it can be collapsed back into the OMB categories if we want that. But we highlighted the ethnic groups that are common here, but allowed for other write-ins if there are other ethnic groups. And we have used this in other settings, and we changed the ethnic groups we mention based on the setting, but still use the same basic format. So this does take work. You know, not everybody can do these percents easily. You have to help them with the math and make sure it adds up to 100. But this is what we did. And then we take those data, and we take the mother and the father, since we're focused on the child, and we assume that the child is half of each. So if the mother is 100% Asian and the father half Asian, half white, we assume the child gets 50% Asian from mother and 25% Asian from father, and is 75% Asian and 25% white. So this, what this does for us is it allows us in regression analysis to have a continuum, and so that we can, so we write about, so in this case, we talk about the percent Asian-ness of this girl, and we put Asian in the model, and she is 75% Asian, and we can use that as a continuous variable. We can also classify, which we do, and you'll see in the analyses, for most of what I'll show you, they're either 100% Asian, 100% white, or a mixed Asian-white group, which is everybody else. So these are the data we've collected. At all three stages, we've collected background, demographics, health, a lot of menstrual information on the girls, physical activity questionnaire, the ARIN questionnaire, which is modifiable for our local activities, and we express that in METs. 3-day diet record, I'll explain that a little bit more. A battery of anthropometry, I'll explain these a little bit more. Tanner staging. And then at exam 2, we got the DEXA and started doing some genotyping. So for exams 2 and 3, we have those data. And then at exam 3, we've added some hormonal data. We're still analyzing exam 3 data. So the anthropometry, we do a lot of detailed anthropometry. So in addition to weight and height, we do sitting height, which gives proportionality. It's of leg length and versus trunk length. Skin fold thicknesses on all sorts of parts of the body. In fact, they're not, it's not all of them. Circumferences and breadths of the bones in different places. And then we do have birth weights as reported by parents, and then we did validate them with birth certificate data. The diet is detailed. We got 3-day diet records from 2 weekdays and a weekend day, so at each time, so a total of 9 records. And we worked with the Cancer Research Center. We ended up actually helping them build their database because the children's foods were often quite different than the elderly cancer patients they had mostly data on. But we generally present average of 3 days for each exam. This is the questionnaire for physical activity, and we express that in METs. And we did clinical Tanner staging, pubertal staging, but for both breast and pubic hair. And this is our DEXA, which is over here at the Clinical Research Center. And it provides, as you probably know, bone and fat and lean. We're focused on the fat tissue, and it provides total body fat, trunk fat, arm fat, and leg fat. And we've developed this trunk periphery fat ratio of the trunk over the arms and legs to help us understand this distribution. So it looks like this. So this is the trunk, and that is then divided by everything else, which is the periphery, to help us get a measure of upper and central body fat, which is more important to risk for disease. So we used ANOVA for our ethnic comparisons and categories, and you'll see we used a general estimating equations, a GEE, with repeated measures for some prediction of this trunk periphery fat ratio, using concatenated data from exams 2 and 3. So just descriptively, to give you a feel of the nutritional data, just going to point out a couple things. This is published if you'd like to have it. And these are from exams 1 and 2. We haven't yet finished the exam 3 data. But the things to note, really, so this is all the girls, just how their diet looks. And this is US recommendations. So you can see they're vegetable intake's a bit low, 2 compared to 3. Their fruit intake a bit low. Their dairy intake a bit low. The meat intake actually a bit low. Their discretionary fat intake quite high. And the added sugar, which is everything, all sugar that's not natural carbohydrate, is quite high. So in the soda intake, of course, we don't have a recommended intake for, but it's high, this is grams, and increasing from exam 1 to 2. So, you know, just glancing at this, you know, they've replaced a lot of the nutritious food with high fat, high sugar, and soda.
So, Rachel, on that, mm-hmm. For the sugar intake, is that 8 teaspoons 15?
Per day.
So you're supposed to have 5, but they were having 15 to 18?
Right. It's adjusted for calories, but I don't have calories on here, but this is right about where the calories are. So, right, they basically have 3 to 4 times the sugar level.
And what's the soda intake equivalent of? How many sodas is that? Like the 130, do you know?
130 grams would be about 2.5
yeah. cans. So this looks at the same data, actually just from exam one, by our ethnic groups. And when you look at the foods this way, you can see also still a somewhat low vegetable intake compared to recommendations, somewhat low fruit intake. The meat is statistically higher among our Asian and mixed Asian than our white. In most cases, we found our mixed ethnic group behaves more like our Asian than our white. And similarly, the dairy is significantly lower among our Asian and mixed Asian than our white. Those were the, and then the sugar is actually higher among the white. And those are the statistically significant differences, but you can see the other variability there. So those are the things that jump out, the sugar, the dairy.
Did you collect enough data to break out populations?
Yeah, I know. We would love to do that, but no, if you remember, our focus was on the Asians. And so we've looked at them a little bit, but we really don't have enough. Sorry to say.
That's another study, though, but we do have in another study.
The total data evidence I see in the office is pretty shocking.
Yeah. We have another study we call the Health Pacific Child Program that was in Waianae and Kau'u and Nukuhala and Waimanalo, and it's just coming out in obesity in February, I believe. Describing the diet of those kids that are primarily Hawaiian, so I don't remember that number. So this is again. I guess we've looked at everything. No, this is a new one. So the calcium you can see. This is now by nutrients. Basically the same data, but by nutrients rather than foods. So you can see the calcium of these two groups is similar and lower than white, but everybody's lower than recommendations by quite a lot in calcium, and especially in dairy and just dietary. This includes supplements here. So calcium is different between the groups and lower, quite a lot lower than recommendations. Fiber also is quite a lot lower than recommendations among everybody, and especially among the Asian and mixed Asian. Iron, interestingly, is different, but it's not low by recommendation. So now, most of the rest is going to be a look at the exam 2 and 3 data, and this is just to show you that at those ages, they're mostly at 10 or 3 at exam 2 and a mean of 10 or 4 at exam 3. You can see this is, we were talking about the mean energy intake, so it's pretty close to that 1800 calorie. This is their BMI distribution at exams 2 and 3. So you can see the skewing to the right of overweight and obese at both times. The overweight is a little better here, though the obese is a little higher, so that's like about 20% overweight and obese. Even in this actually very healthy population, this is sort of, you know, the ones who volunteered were on the healthier end of the spectrum, we would expect. We actually haven't checked. So this is the trunk periphery fat ratio. So first, just to note, so that's the trunk periphery fat ratio, and this is by age. So just ignoring the bars for a moment,
And just looking at the ages, in general, there's a slight tendency, this is significant, to increase overall the truncalness of the fat proportion with age. But especially when you break it down by bi-iliac tertile, this is the bi-iliac, so the width here, you can see that as they get have a larger bi-iliac breadth, especially it's more evenly distributed there, the fat tends to be more truncal. So the wider the iliac breadth here, the more truncal the fat, and less on the periphery. When you look by ethnic group, here again you still see our Asian and our Asian white mixed group behaving more similarly, so they have more truncal fat than the white, so they tend to carry more of their fat in the upper body versus the periphery. Now this is birth weight, so as this is the DEXA fat, and these are birth weight tertiles, so as birth weight increases, they have more fat, both all over the body and on the trunk. But interestingly, as the birth weight tertile increases, the trunk periphery fat ratio decreases. So in other words, as the birth weight tertile increases, the body fat is less truncal. So higher body fat, less of a tendency to put it, I mean, higher birth weight, less of a tendency to put it in the upper body, and that's significant. So we looked at predictors of this trunk periphery fat ratio and looked at these variables, the Asian ethnicity. We see significantly the more Asian-ness, the more truncal the body fat. That's a positive direction. The greater this bi-iliac breadth, the more truncal, and the smaller the birth weight, a negative value, the more truncal. So that's that Barker hypothesis stuff, you know, that the smallness seems to predispose to a rapid and rapid weight gain and putting that fat in the upper body, a more risky situation. And this is controlling for age and Tanner stage and activity and energy and height. So those are adjusted for in that determination. So the amount of that effect is that for every 1% of Asian ethnicity, a 10% increase in truncalness of the fat. And for every 1 pound less of birth weight, a 3% increase in truncalness of the fat. And for every centimeter increase of bi-iliac breadth, also a 3% increase in the truncalness of the fat. So again, we controlled in the model for age, maturation stage, height, dietary energy, and physical activity. So our interpretation of this is that the lower birth weight, I didn't really talk about the birth length, but the lower birth weight and more truncal versus peripheral body fat likely reflects the fetal influences on body composition and metabolism that affect the future adolescent body fat distribution that we're measuring. And the positive association of this bi-iliac breadth with the trunk peripheral fat ratio likely reflects the adolescent skeletal growth, suggesting that skeletal size or shape may affect where the fat gets put. And the remaining effect of Asian ethnicity may reflect a genetic tendency associated with something about being Asian towards a more central versus peripheral fat. We are looking at some genetic polymorphisms, and I have a doctoral student, Mika Vihanudeva, who's looking at leptin and leptin receptor polymorphism. She's still working on this, but she is finding a significant association, or having this polymorphism is associated with a less trunk periphery fat ratio. So there may be some genetic markers for some of this. So we've been finding this trunk periphery fat ratio a measure of distribution of body fat. As you know, over time we've used different measures. We've used waist, hip, and other kinds of measures, but this allows us to really measure the fat, and it may have predictive value to be able to interpret both individual and population risk
as people go through the lifespan. But further work for the genetic polymorphisms, and now I'd like to get into the hormonal data too, to quantify the risks and protections for trunk periphery fat ratio at different life stages, and to relate that to specific health and diseases would be needed to actually define specific clinical targets. That's most of what I was going to share with you today. These are co-investigators, including graduate students that have worked with us. We worked sitting at FAM. One was done in Dr. Kearney's office. And the staff, many at the CRC, and some at Kaiser. Bob Bidwell helped us with the Tanner staging, standardized us on that. And our sources of funding from the Department of Defense, Cancer Research Center, NIH, and USDA. So that's what I have for you today. So we can talk about this or...
I have a question about your study. You know, one of the things that we know is that the body distribution of fat is related to the amount of estrogen and goes through adolescence. When you look at these girls who happen to have the increase in the truncal thing, is there a correlation? You know, maybe you did it and I caused my... Is there a correlation between Tanner stages or your estrogen levels?
We haven't looked at the hormone levels yet. They're Tanner... once you've controlled for these other things, it's no longer significant, but if not, it is significant, so it's another marker.
Yes.
So I think very much like you. In fact, I view the Asian skeleton as being slightly more androgenic, obviously on a normal scale, but, you know, the androgen, estrogen, what you see is a slightly larger shoulder breadth, and less of a slightly, although the, you know, so there's a pelvic shape, so the iliac is a little bit broader, but not necessarily the trochanter. In another study, we've measured the trochanter, and that's actually a little narrower. So I think that results in a skeletal tendency to put the fat in the upper body, and also a tendency to have slightly shorter legs and arms, so there's just less of it there. So, you know, where are you going to put it? You put it where you've got a skeleton. So I think very mechanically about this. But I do think, you know, when you look at an androgen-estrogen scale, to get back to your question, that is a little bit more androgenic, a little bit more of a male versus a female skeletal structure. And I do wonder if, you know, there's a slightly different hormonal balance there that is important.
It would be nice to look at the estrogen level in this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't think, you know, the estrogen, it's really hard in adolescence to figure out how to sample when their menstruation is, you know, crazy or non-existent. We do have growth hormone and IGF. I'm not sure. I think we have some sort of estrogen marker at exam 3 at the outcome. So,
interesting.
And what then drives the bi-iliac breadth?
Yeah, you know, it's not been studied a lot. So if any of you, I've been trying to get into sort of the obstetric literature and the endocrinology literature. I don't find a lot about it. It goes by a lot of different names in the older literature. I don't really know, but again, it's hormonal, I believe, and it's the breadth is a marker for an overall shape. I've been trying to find other markers of this in the Kaiser database, and I'm looking at, you know, at delivery we get concave and these kinds of descriptions of the pelvis, and I'm not sure that they relate, but I do think that the more flat pelvis may have a wider breadth. It ends up basically kind of tipping out, and what we're measuring, which is the tips of the iliac crest, is actually wider. But no, we're still trying to interpret that ourselves. And unfortunately, our data are not so closely measured to really be able to track the growth of that. So we are forced to do comparisons, which doesn't really tell us exactly. So. But yeah, so in a whole other body of work that we've done, I didn't present here, looks at this calcium, and we do see the calcium, you know, like you saw popular in the literature there for a while, was that more calcium was also associated with lower body fat, which again goes and was also associated with Asians having more, for the same BMI, more body fat. Now, overall, they didn't have higher BMIs, but for the same BMI, had more body fat. And so I'm not sure whether the mechanism of the calcium might be through this through growing of bone and the shape of the bone that then influences where the fat's put, because we really don't know what it is about this calcium-fat relationship. There's lots of hypotheses, the conjugated linoleic acid and lipolysis and a whole a series of hypotheses. But we do see that association here, that also the lower calcium, the more upper body fat and more iliac fat. We measured this iliac skin for thickness as well.
Is there any correlation between BMI and the ratio?
And which?
BMI and the ratio between the, you know, the truncal fat and the vertebral fat. The reason why I ask you, you know, not too many of us happen to have machine to do the testing, but we can do BMI, so it would be nice if somehow is something that's, not exactly, but you can say, yeah, you know, you do BMI minus this, or you ask multiply by two, or whatever, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's a good question. We should look at it again more carefully. We've done that, and what we've tried doing is adding different measures to BMI, like skin folds,
right,
to see if we could, how well we could predict it. And we could get pretty close with adding some skin folds, like 90%.
Because that would be something easy to measure, too. You know,
yeah,
you can measure BMI, you can measure skin fold. And if it comes close to, not exactly, but close to that.
Does the seated standing height ratio because that's something that you really use.
Not
many of us are going to want to buy caliper, but everybody's got a chair.
Repeatability of caliper is horrible, you know. I mean, even within my team that I had standardized, you know, I'd like to have the same person measuring all the time. But I'm still working on those. Yet height certainly matters, and leg length, sitting height matters. But I don't really haven't really created an algorithm.
Yeah, that would be helpful.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, really, very useful.
I mean, I guess one reason I haven't is because still the trunk periphery fat ratio itself is not, you know, conceptually makes
very
sense
low
to us, but we haven't been able to demonstrate risk for a specific disease.
Are you doing? Because
I mean, they're still.
These are pretty young girls, so you probably don't see all the complication, but you might be able to see maybe some changes in the glucose tolerance. I don't know if you're doing glucose tolerance on them. I mean, you probably don't find it happens to be a pre-diabetes, but perhaps you will see a difference if you do glucose tolerance.
We have
idea. Or insulin. That's great. Yeah.
I haven't looked at it yet.
Yeah.
But we have it. We haven't tried to do glucose tolerance that's an add-on that I would like.
You're measuring insulin level.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be great.
Because
that might give you some information. I mean, it would be very difficult to measure if they already happen to have atherosclerosis, things like that, because probably plaques are too small to be able to be seen, you know. But maybe changes in the way that they produce insulin, or even how well that receptors for the insulin happens to be truly the glucose tolerance, you know, that might give you some idea.
Right.
So the insulin per se and the glucose tolerance would be just to see how well the receptors are working in relation to the insulin. That might be something that might be useful. Might help you to validate the ratio. You know,
that's the thing. I mean, so far it's a logical step, but it's not a natural validation because we don't have a disease outcome. Do you think that would be enough to validate it?
Well, I think if you happen to find, you know, a lot of abnormalities in there. The other thing that probably you might like to check is maybe check for creatinine clearance. Because the other area which these kids are going to have some problems is the kidneys. And you're probably not going to find anyone that happens you have an abnormal creatinine clearance, but I bet you that you're going to find a small little difference. Mm-hmm. And it's still normal, but borderline normal in those ones who happen you had the obesity. We see it, we see that, and that's reported in kids who are 20, 22 years old, over 95% BMI. You know, you have abnormal glucose tolerance and you have abnormal creatinine clearance. Mm-hmm. So it would be nice to see if you see this and see if this works.
Well, the nice thing is it's outside of the girl, so we do have the electronic medical record.
Yeah.
But you need to have the needs for that.
Yeah, it will not be that difficult to do it. And it's not an expensive small grant to do it, probably. You
know, yeah, but so it's got to be something that would be done with a, if I meant it that way, that would be done with a normal exam. This way.
Yeah.
Probably not.
Right.
I'd have to do it.
Yeah.
So what's your recommendations for clinicians? Because, you know, we've talked about this. It's so funny about dealing with our Asian patients versus our Caucasian patients. Yeah. And we're, how do you assess them in terms of?
Well, you know, I have to say, you know, it's I find it awkward, but I do, all the data that I've looked at has suggested to me, you know, certainly those dietary things are things that aren't going to hurt. There's the soda, there's the fat, there's the sugar, and there's the dairy. And it doesn't have to be dairy, it could be calcium. I mean, like, there is the lactose tolerance issue, but even there, that is something, too, that I think can be worked with. You know, like, you can start with small amounts of yogurt and things like that. And I do think those help.
So not focusing really on the BMI, because it still might be normal or under the CDC standards, but more closely.
You know, I'm thinking about, you know, when you measure our Asian kids, they're often not overweight. They haven't reached the 85th percentile yet, and yet, you know, there's a strong family history of cardiovascular disease and diabetes, and we're not, because the U.S. has not incorporated the Asian data into their CDC standards.
Well, let me avoid that for another moment and just say that even in our PACDESH study that we're just starting, we've just done a pilot, this is an intervention study we're preparing for in the Kaiser setting, we have selected kids who are overweight and obese, and those parents don't think they're overweight and obese, and they are by BMI guidelines. So, you know, even starting there, I think, is still a step, I think. You know, we have some wonderful anecdotes among our pilot. I mean, the parents said, this is a healthy heavy. you know, I mean, they just don't see it as, but yeah, I think there is evidence that a slightly different BMI would be valuable for Asians. And so if clinically, I think, you know, given the reality of the whole field, even with my data, as I say, I don't really have enough yet to recommend another cut point. But the field does, that, you know, other people do. And I think not so much for children, but just based on population groups, I think a slightly lower cut point could be argued. But then a slightly higher could probably be argued for Pacific Islanders.
Well, some of the stuff that you show, you know, that there were the intake of fat, it was like about 3 or 4 times more than what this recommended for.
Right, that's more clear cut at least.
And that's actually, you talk about increases of carbohydrates too, you know, it was higher, but you get 4 calories per gram of carbohydrate. How many you get for fat? It's 8 or 9. So actually, you know, when you talk about putting weight, the fat really makes a huge difference down there.
So really helping people find places where that fat is located in food. And now, on
so
that note,
fat tastes good.
You know what I've had best on an intervention level? I've had best luck with the beverages. That's the one we're about to study. You know, it's conceptually it's easier. You know, certainly the soda is conceptually easier. Just, you know, swap this for that. You know, the complexity of nutrients in foods is
difficult.
Yep.
And but we've had good luck with beverages, and you know, that's a lot of calories. It's not the fat, but it's the sugar and calories. Some of the beverages, you know, maybe the, there are a few beverages that are.
Have you any preliminary data on blood substances that are related to central obesity? Dr. Buddha mentioned the insulin, the glucose tolerance, but how about C-reactive protein and these other things that are related to obesity, whether it be truncal or peripheral obesity, yeah, or total obesity? That would be an interesting addition to your study. I think you've already got a base number of patients, but it's a matter of doing more invasive studies.
Right. Could that be measured out on stored samples? We do still have the stored
blood.
Yeah.
Could be. Maybe.
Frozen samples.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You stored frozen blood there,
yeah,
or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've done a little bit of the analysis. We haven't looked at it yet, but
yeah, that would be a very interesting addition.
I think we have done it, but I don't have it. I can't report on it yet. Come back next year.
Well, it seems to me with several hundred in each arm, you'd have quite a bit of a...
That's a good idea. That might...
Power
these things
for that, yeah.
Would help ground those measures in clinical...
Yep.
Have you taken cholesterol measures?
No.
Okay, well...
We did in a study in the Pacific...
Do you have
any parents? Yeah, my experience, you've got big parents, because they only... Yeah, we have a little bit of data on the parents. We have heights and weights.
And like the nutritional data, I was struck more by the similarity than the differences. Mm-hmm. You know,
between...
We're all not having enough calcium, and all having too much.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if you're white or Asian.
Yeah.
I think we all watch the same TV shows. We're more sane than that.
Yeah, no, you're right. And that's...
Which makes
that's
it
fine too.
Easier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think the value of looking at differences is just another way to understand what could be going on. But yeah, if it's not, it's not.
Yeah,
I agree with you.
To
easier.
Convince the parents that you've got to change the whole family's... You know, because it's really kind of confronting them with the idea you're fat.
Yeah.
That doesn't go for something.
Right.
But that's where, you know, some of this contextual, you know, I really, you know, I'm a trained dietitian, but, you know, I don't really believe that the only way we should be approaching it is through counseling. You know, I really do think that it's a tough environment. Yeah, you know, the food environment and our the way we live and... that we need to look at other ways to help support people to naturally do the things we want them to do that we've learned are healthier.
Yeah. You know, from the physician point of view too, we have such a minimal impact on what people are doing. You know, we see it for these little sound bites versus what happens on TV, you know, that bombards them every single day. So
yeah.
I don't know that health in the physician's office is going to end up being a very effective place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what our PAC-DASH intervention is trying to do is looking at how people are, what they're thinking about, the readiness to change thing, whether they want to make some changes, and then targeting there. I think just bombarding with too much information that's not where they're at can be counterproductive. But, I think the trick is to, if there are people that are, or wherever they're at, to help push them in the right direction. But
does Kaiser have, you work with Kaiser here,
yeah,
do they have programs where they have group sessions, which are probably more economical?
They have, but
they had some funding for that. We're working with the Kaiser Non-Occluded Clinic, and they had a great program, and they deal with mostly MedQuest patients, and then funding for that through Kaiser, and I think the Quest stopped, and so it was dissolved. So it's not much.
Mrs. Tellio,
There's a lot of interest in it. There was a state interest there.
Because it's really, you know, the health plans that will take an interest in this. Mm-hmm. Start shifting around just population based.
Mm-hmm. Let me tell you.
It's really going to be hard to know.
Although, you know, I think my sister always tells me that she's not a physician, and she always says, "You guys always underestimate your power, mm-hmm. what you can say in 5 minutes." Mm-hmm. And she always tells me all these different stories. But and I think that's, you know, I'm not saying that we can fix it, but you know, planting the seed once a year, I think it's.
Yeah, but you have to choose just the right individual that you have to plant the seed.
But that's exactly the idea of what we're trying to do with CACDESH, is figure out where they're at. And even if they're at not thinking about it at all, then to be talking just about, you know, trying to introduce it, versus for the person who's been trying and having difficulty, they don't plant that seed.
Yeah.
And we're asking the physician to give the message. We do the assessment and say, please help them.
Well, the exercise prescription, I mean, it not only is counseling, but actually writing the prescription. I mean, there was a really old study, the Green study, I think that was adults, but the exercise prescription did increase compliance. Mm-hmm. And I don't really, I know we had discussed that at one point, but there's actually a written, you know, reduce whatever.
Yep, that's what we're doing. We've got both diet and exercise, and it was given to them. We actually wrote prescription on it. We've gone round in circles with the physicians about whether it should say prescription or recommendation. But at any rate, I'm not sure where we've settled. I think it says recommendation now. I can't remember why they didn't want to say prescription. I'm not sure if it's a legal thing. But we give one thing to the child, one thing to the parent, and one thing to the physician, and ask them. And it's all basically the same message, but with slightly different approach.
How is peripheral obesity defined?
Well, as I've defined it, it's everything that's not the trunk, so it's arms and legs.
And so there would be just a ratio of that weight to total. Total body weight.
Well, it's fat. That fat in the way we were using it's body fat.
So you measure fat of extremities versus body, but you relate that to BMI.
Yeah, that's what he was asking. I mean, our whole intent was to look at the fat because we think that's more. Biologically meaningful. I appreciate, though, for clinical purposes, what could you use?
So the DEXA study focuses on fat, and makes you delineate fat.
Right.
I
mean,
that's not readily
available to you. Right. We could do the same analysis with BMI, and we'd get, I think, similar but not quite as strong results. What you wouldn't be able to see is the real upper versus lower body differences. That, I mean, we're interested in trying to understand what's going on. You're asking me a different question as well as the clinical application of this. And I don't directly know how the BMI. I mean, you could use the BMI the same way.
How about waist hip circumference, or even just waist? Did you find any correlation there?
We did. You could do waist to hip, or just waist.
So a lot of people are saying that we're getting more and more towards measuring kids' waist, and that there are now, you know, country specific waist circumference curves coming out, that sort of thing. So that's
It's hard though, isn't it?
It's really hard. It's really hard.
It's hard to get, it's not really much better than a skin fold in terms of getting a reliable measure, but it's probably still, even with all its errors, the scale is such that it's probably still meaningful.
So that's why people keep falling back on BMI. It's far from perfect, but it actually, it at least gives you a sense of where you're at.
Yeah.
And then if you supposedly correlate it then with your diet history and your activity history, then you've got an assessment of some sort of risk.
But as you say, we don't yet have waist cut points for children either. Really.
No.
No.
So do you think they'll eventually move to an ethnic specific BMI?
Good
countries? I mean, it's an international problem.
Yeah. Well, you know, for the little children, they've done an international growth study. I suspect eventually we'll do something like that for adolescents as well, and you know, other child ages. It's so hard, though, because, again, the mixed ethnicity.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, I don't work in a clinical setting, and I prefer, you know, to do things on continuums. You know, I appreciate having a cut point, but I really kind of object to them in a biologic way, you know, that for any individual, there's going to be some variability.
Right. Right.
And you just
right.
pick the, you know,
right.
it's a guidepost, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think the way I kind of like to think about it is whether we can find a way to, I mean, nutrition is like that, you know, these exact numbers are not really what's so helpful. It's the continuum or, you know, the ranking or something like that. But so if we could find some way to say this is, you know, here's the range of variability and, you know, and let things sort of overlap at the edges, you know, so there can be some clinical judgment in between. But I appreciate that at the end of the day, you need something to say, okay, this number I'm going to go this way and at this number I'm going to go that way.
But maybe that number should describe your amount of risk you have, not your fat. You don't have to call it obese.
Yeah.
You're at high risk.
Right.
Yeah.
That's why those things like the 5-to-1 almost none the intake survey that one sheet that a lot of people use. I mean, it just kind of you can use it on everybody, and you can still see that you might be at okay BMI, but you're drinking 4 sodas a day.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing.
No, I mean a lot of the kids that are not, their BMI is fine.
Yeah.
But then the diet is awful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we too.
And
I mean,
your parents are skinny too. Some of them, they're all skinny.
Yeah, but
you
they
know,
don't drink any milk or they don't drink anything other than soda.
We try to talk in health terms too, more than obesity and so on. But, you know, at the same time, that is a risk indicator. So it's nice to have a term for it. I'm all ears as to how to best talk about it clinically. Want to call a spade, yet you know, you want to do it in the context of health.
Yeah.
We're doing care of health.
Yeah.
I think obesity is a very loaded term, even overweight.
We did a very old study, and you know, the Filipino ethnicity kids had low BMI but high cholesterol. Samoans had high BMI, low cholesterol. Hawaiians had high BMI, high cholesterol. So cholesterol is a variation of, you know, fat, where you think is fat, people have high cholesterol. Well, that's not. Skinny people have low cholesterol. So there's the risks are not necessarily based on BMI.
Yeah.
You know, and there's other things going on.
Right. Yeah.
It's diet.
It's fairly crude.